Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. Today, I have a very interesting guest on, and we're going to talk about his little travels to get to where he is today. His name is Jerry. So, Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nancy.
Now, Jerry, you're an artist, amongst a few other things. So let's talk a little bit about who you are, what got you started, you know, doing art, and what happened, because you had a few little changes that you've made.
Yes. After a very driven career as an artist living on the East Coast, New York, and producing an enormous body of work, it got very clear that life was changing, and somehow the way I was living my life as an artist no longer served in the way it had. And so after a month-long fast, it became clear that I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice, or I could go for that allurement I was sensing that was something greater. And on the strength of that feeling, I destroyed all my paintings and gave everything I owned away, and then lived that way for the next 15 years. And later in life, I was asked to write a book, and there are several documentary films, and now a feature film being made all around that particular event.
Do you think, Jerry, that there are a lot of people who right now, and say like in the last maybe 15 years, have had a very hard time trying to figure out who they are and their way of life and what to do?
I think there are many people going through that right now. I think it's so much in the collective. Our identity as a country, as a world, is coming undone. So I think, you know, often it's the artists, the poets, the more sensitive among us who are the first to go through those little transformations before the world does. And I think in many ways what I see in retrospect, although I did that in 1979, I see that our world is going through that now, and it makes complete sense in the service of the work I do in relation to other people. So I think there are many of us going through it.
When you first started doing paintings, how old were you?
When I began, well, I think I began like a child, like most children. I began in earnest in high school, you know, taking painting more seriously on to college, and then I just took off on my own.
I looked at some of your paintings, and I actually like them. They're very, very unique. But there's a lot of mixed energies in it. So can you maybe explain to the listeners, when you start to do a painting, what energies come to you that create what your painting turns out to be?
Well, the paintings are what you saw on my website of the paintings. That's the work that was destroyed. I'm not doing paintings now, but I think you're correct in the mixed feelings in them. As a young painter, I explored my fears, and so in a certain way, I would paint into my limitations. I would paint the scary things. You know, I dealt with insanity and the Holocaust, and I did series of paintings that had to do with some pretty dark subjects, because I found in facing them, at some level, I needed to find God in that exploration, or some level of mystery that I could identify with in order to overcome my own, you know, limitations and fears. So that's what the paintings were about, and they are very mixed. I think in some way also part of what was going on in those paintings was there's an element of duality, where I did a whole series of 80 panels, which are also on the website, that were very much about, I was calling them angels and demons, and, you know, trying to bring the opposites together, the inherent duality in human nature together. And I think the place it came together wasn't with my attempt to do it myself, but with that final surrender and destroying the work. So, you know, I mean, the paintings were that kind of exploration for me. Now I'm doing the sculptures, which are a whole other thing. They're coming from a very different spirit, I feel.
Yeah, and some of your sculptures are actually quite nice, too. They have different names out of all the sculptures that you have done so far. Which one do you like the best?
Oh, I don't know that it works that way. I think whatever I'm working on, I usually am the most excited about. And then in short order, I hardly even notice them. So, you know, I think there are some that are better than others, just generally because the magic came through in unexpected ways that really carried them in a different kind of way. So it's hard to say which I like best.
Do the sculptures that you're doing, do they have different meanings for you also?
Well, the meaning comes through often later. I think I love what Joseph Campbell says about art. You know, he describes art as being of three different categories. The lowest form of art he calls pornography, which is art designed to elicit desire, whether it's advertising art or just plain pornographic art. And the next level he calls propaganda, which is art with an agenda. And so to go into art with an agenda or some level of meaning, I think that fits into the category of propaganda. And what he describes as the highest art of all, it's simply the artist is as surprised at what comes as anyone else, and it simply leaves one in awe. And so I think that's a pretty good description of art. Meaning can often come later when we are awed by our own exploration and that inspiration comes through the work. It's just a whole other animal.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of your, even the sculptures, they have a lot of different energy to them also. And it almost appears like it was, like you're saying, at that moment, that's what you were feeling and that's kind of what came from it. So that's pretty interesting because a lot of people, not a lot, but some of the artists will start with something in mind and then work from there, which I think it's usually better to allow your creativity to come through and just follow, you know, follow through with that. Whether it's in a meditative state or just a state of total relaxation, you're usually going to get your best work done that way. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think everyone starts with something. I mean, we it's pretty hard to begin anything without some little inkling. But I think very often our original ideas fall by the wayside when we really hook into some larger inspiration. So, I mean, you know, it's often some minuscule little seed or some little idea that most artists start with, and yet, as you say, it is the greatest work that comes out of that relationship ultimately with the mystery, those things that come through on their own and only make sense later.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also, on your website, and the website is www.handsofalchemy.com.
Alchemy.
You have something called the process on there. Can you explain what that is?
The process. Well, our website was a gift to us. I think you're referring to the process of creating the work. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's simply works in progress that our website person put on there for us. So, you know, just to give people an idea of how it all, you know, of the work in as they develop, just to give some idea what that all looks like, how things begin. So there are photographs of that.
It's pretty interesting because you even talk about the hair on most of your sculptures, where it comes from nylon rope and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's actually quite good what they put on there for you. It does explain a lot of stuff, and I find it very interesting because most people don't explain a process, but it's good that it is explained for years because a lot of people would want to understand, I think, more about your sculptures once they see them because they are quite unique. Now, you guys also do a lot of other things, you know, and, I mean, you do lectures, and you have done lectures, so do you have any more lectures coming up soon?
Yes, I go to California in a couple months, and I have it. I speak annually at Pacifica Graduate Institute in their mythology program. So I have that coming up, and while it's in Santa Barbara, I currently live on Whidbey Island, Washington. And while I'm there, I have another event at a large yoga center called Yoga Soup coming up. And there's an event back in New York, which will happen this summer sometime. It hasn't been fixed yet.
And so if they want to find out when the lectures are going to be, they can eventually get them on the website. Is that correct?
Yes, the schedule is on our website.
Okay, good, because I was looking. Now, you also do seminars. Let's talk about your seminars, because you have a lot of those. So maybe talk about what the seminars are for, and, again, what people hope most of the time to get out of your seminars.
Well, I think, as we spoke earlier, that many people are going through these radical shifts within their own lives. And I think, you know, being someone who fully traversed that territory, sometimes kicking and screaming like most of us, I feel like, you know, I know a little bit about it. And, you know, I think our journeys are so completely individual in that they embody all of our hopes and fears and possibilities and impossibilities. But generally speaking, there's a roadmap that can be a sort of template that once we have traversed the territory ourselves, we can't necessarily know the details of another person's life, but we can certainly show them a roadmap. And the places that seem most hopeless and impossible, I think someone who has walked that journey knows the possibilities there. And mostly what our workshops have been about is just simply being there in that capacity for other people going through that kind of transformation. And as I said, it's a time in our world where there are many people going through it. You know, and I happen to be a willing participant in the way I jumped in, but that doesn't matter a whole lot. I think it often comes by way of a divorce or financial ruin or, you know, physical breakdown or something external often is the catalyst. But the simple fact is to fully stay with that journey as if it were dealt from the hand of God is the best seat in the house for each of us, and that seat is unique. So our work, we are simply there for people in the capacity of holding the space for them to do what they need to do.
Do you find that, Jerry, a lot of people have a hard time letting go of the past hurts, pains, angers, or guilt that they may be holding on from childhood?
Yes, I think it's the nature of the mind to hold on to, you know, everything, good and bad. Change is often difficult. We can get really pitted in our attachments. You know, we can be just as attached in a sentimental way to some better time in the past and not really be fully present in our life here and now. So it's certainly a human challenge to give ourselves to change. But it's inevitable, and, you know, I don't think many of us can avoid changing. And there's nothing more deadly and stagnating than to avoid the inevitable changes we're faced with.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, today, Jerry, having a hard time, you know, facing a lot of the changes that are going to be occurring and have already actually started to occur, you know, plus holding on to their emotional, you know, hurt, pains, angers, guilt, fear, whatever words they choose, you know. And I found that through when I have a consultation with people to get them to let go of a lot of their most inner feelings of that hurt, pain, anger, guilt, and fear, it's hard because they tell me if I let go, I have nothing. And it's like, well, that's not really true, but, you know, look at it a different way. If you stay in the hurt, pain, anger, guilt, and fear, then that's usually what you're going to continue to bring. So if you would try to work with it a little bit to let it go and just allow some better energy to come in or allow yourself to feel a different form of energy, you know, would that help? So a lot of people have a very rough time letting go of what they know to go forward with what they don't know, which is what you actually did when you destroyed all your paintings and everything and just let faith lead the way. People today have a very hard time with that. Is there something you could tell them that you did that helped you to be able to just let go and trust?
Well, the best thing anyone can do is be a willing participant in their own transformation, whatever that looks like or however it unfolds. And I would say to people who say if they let go, there will be nothing, at some level, that's true, but you can say the same thing about an open hand. You know, if we're holding on to something that no longer serves us, we can't receive what's coming or what the next moment calls for. So somehow, it's that emptiness that is necessary to be filled by our next inspired possibility. Or it's like the black holes in space. You know, I mean, in some way, when you look in space, they look like nothing. And yet, they're these powerful entities that can create or consume a star. And so there's a kind of nothing that has to do with living too unadventurous and boring a life, and there's a kind of nothing that takes a risk and puts us in a place where we're really calling on the gods, and you know, and we need grace, and we need the help of forces larger than our own. And that's the kind of healthy emptiness that is required for change and for that, you know, to bring into our lives that next thing that keeps us alive and happy.
Right now, a lot of people, I don't know if they know what being happy is, because they listen to the television and they live in this fear of what's being told of them, and somehow that's got to find a way to change. Now, there's also one of the workshops and seminars that you do. It's called Awakening Through Dreams. How does that one work?
Well, we have done different forms of dream work over the years. And, you know, being an artist, and I'm sure many artists can identify with this, the creative process and the interpretations that come, the meaning that comes as one is involved in creation, it's not so different from dream work in that, you know, the unconscious has a way of coming through the creative process. And there's a certain way that meaning comes through, and it's like a language. And I think, generally speaking, artists know the language of that unconscious. And so dream work isn't so very different in that people, you know, what we do in some of our groups is we share dreams, and then we work on the interpretations in a very systematic way. And I just have a lot of faith in what comes out by way of group participation in that process, because nobody often holds the whole piece. And there's something about a group working on a dream together in a very compassionate, trusting way, where what emerges is a surprise to everyone. And, you know, because of having done that work a lot, I find it's pretty amazing what can come through for people, and it's so very useful in helping all of us to track our dreams and to figure it out for ourselves, or to work with other people to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. How important, Jerry, do you think it is for people to kind of look at their imaginations and look into the different mysteries to, you know, bring themselves either together or find out who they are? How does that work?
Well, imagination isn't making things up. When I think of imagination, I think of, you know, the imagination of nature or the imagination of consciousness, which is like, in some way, it's pretty freeform in what can be running through our small brains. Yet at another level, those imaginings that make us come alive are often hooked into a larger collective imagination. And so I come to trust them. So I think, you know, if we eliminate that possibility, then, you know, life can be pretty literal, and there's nothing more deadly than just to keep it fixed on the literal. I mean, this is where you have fundamentalism in all of its forms, is that things just are boiled down to the literal, to where it's kill or be killed. And I think imagination opens possibilities. I mean, it's often the things we imagine that seem so completely impossible that actually come into form, and we find what we need to bring them into form. So imagination is paramount, I think, for all of our lives.
How do you feel about children with their imaginations today, and how the for whatever reason, it appears that they don't want the children to really have imaginations. They don't want them to dream. They want them to be settled and contained, and this is the way it is, and there's nothing outside the box. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's what you call Prozac. I think I feel it's probably one of our worst sins as adults to impose that on children. I don't know that people do it so completely deliberately. I think we can do it in such an insidious way. You know, like I know people who they keep their children so completely involved in activities, sports and gymnastics and archery and anything else they can find. I mean, that too is a way to thwart the imagination. I mean, I think children need a lot of space to have their imaginations run free and to find out who they are and what kind of mystery they're living in by way of just simply being and exploring that. So, I mean, no one deliberately, or very few people deliberately want to thwart a child's imagination, but I think we can do it pretty unconsciously just simply by following social protocol. If you look at people with children, it becomes a competition of who can do the most and how much they push their children into doing all the things that look like success, when in fact, you know, we're doing a lot of damage. I have a couple artist friends who live in a teeny little house, and they have two kids, and they are the most extraordinary people, and their trick is to simply be present with their children in the most beautiful way. I mean, one of their daughters won the award for young violinists in the whole country. So, I mean, it's like, I think when you can, and those children had a lot of space. They wouldn't even buy their daughter a computer when she went to college. I mean, she had to go to the library. And so, you know, one would think, oh, poor dear. And yet these kids are so extraordinary because what they value is their own imaginations, and they're very unique people. You know, they don't fit the mold.
No, they don't. That's one of the things that I'm doing, actually, Jerry, is I moved to New Mexico to find land, find funding, build a school, open it, and the school is called the School of Now, which is a school that, one, will never be outdated, and two, the children have their space. They get to be who they are, and we help them to find out, you know, in their own way who they are. So it's a different kind of setup for a school that, you know, most children would know about. And it's actually to encourage their creativity and let them be who they are, you know, which are the things that public schools aren't really welcoming for children at this time. But that's one of the things that I'm doing, is because I really don't like to see all of the drugs that are being passed out to these children to, you know, settle them down or, you know, in my opinion, keep them more like a zombie and not let their creativity happen and not let them know who they are. So that's what I'm in the process of doing. Now, you also do a chant. It's called Getaway to the Soul. How important is it to chant and to meditate?
Well, I don't. Excuse me. I don't do that. It's my wife does. You know, she writes chants, and she's done women's spirituality groups for, you know, a good 10 years, and has worked at the Chinook Learning Center. Now the Whidbey Institute was on staff. So, I mean, she works with adults, and so chanting for her has been very important, and she brings it. You know, I did a book tour and toured with Parabola magazine when they featured our film in their film festival, and Marilyn, my wife, always opened our events with a song or a chant. So I just think it's a really beautiful way to enter any kind of a, you know, an almost ritual space in trying to present something meaningful. Music really does it. She also does weddings and funerals, and she brings her music to that. So, you know what a song can do at a wedding. Everybody ends up in tears, but it gets us out of our head and puts us into our emotions, where we can actually feel and be present to what's going on in a different kind of way rather than in a distant intellectual way. So I think that, you know, music like art has that capacity.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your book. So please tell the listeners the name of your book, how they can find them, and then we'll go into a little bit of detail about why you wrote it.
Well, it's called The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation, and you can get it anywhere. It's on Amazon. It's published by Sentient Publications in Boulder, Colorado. I was actually, you know, because of the film, there's a film about my life that, as I mentioned, Parabola featured, and as a result of that film, I was approached by a publisher and asked if I would be willing to write a book, and I had never written much of anything, and I said, sure, when do you want it? And she asked if I could do it in 4 months, and that's what I did. In some way, you know, the book, I feel like I've been working with people so long, and aspects of my story have been so useful to people going through their own metaphoric death experiences, that the stories I share with people and have shared over the years were completely present and available to me. So writing the book, it was pretty much a download. I mean, I had to certainly cultivate the craft of writing a little bit more, and my publisher, who loved what I was doing, took me under her wing and really edited the book personally. So I think it came out pretty good for a non-writer, not having everything to do with my skill, that's for sure.
The movie, is it out already?
Yeah, In the Hands of Alchemy is out. It's now being distributed by Sentient Publication, my book publisher. The original was Parabola Magazine. And now there's a new feature film by a Danish filmmaker, Hans Fabian Wellenweber, who is, I've been working on that all week, actually. He's writing the script now. And I've been working with him on details and just there's a lot of writing going into that as well. And that's not out. You know, I expect that'll be 3 years in the process. It's a feature film with actors, and at the very least it'll be Danish with subtitles, but he has Hollywood connections and he's trying to do it in America in English.
Now, are you going to be in the movie yourself, Jerry, or are you just going to have actors do it?
No, yeah, I won't be in it. This is not a documentary. But In the Hands of Alchemy is a documentary, the existing film. This is a feature film. You know, it's my story, basically, based on my book, based on the stuff we're working on now. But I won't be in it. No, I mean, you know, it goes from 1979 when I destroyed my art and gave everything I owned away up into the present day. So they're going to need a young person to carry that role.
Well, I would think if it's the present day, you should at least appear in the ending of it.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if whatever he, you know, the director has in mind. I don't know. I trust him. I love working with a European filmmaker. I can tell you, In the Hands of Alchemy was made in this country by some pretty intense filmmakers, and that was not an easy task. But I just love working with this guy. It's a whole other sensibility, and I trust what he does. If he wants to, at some level, you know, bring me in at the end, I'd be willing to do that. But however it works. Fine.
Now, when you were talking about your book and using your experiences, out of all the experiences, Jerry, that you have gone through, which one has meant the most to you?
Well, taking that little step and really trusting that minuscule prompting to let everything go, let my identity go, walk into that thing that looks like death and find the life that's waiting in there. I mean, that was the template for everything my life is about now. Everything going on in my life, everything that came out of that initial level of trust was, and it remains, the single most important thing I've ever done with my life.
when it comes to you and your wife, and you guys do work together, she has done a song. Does she do the songs herself?
Does she sing them or write
yeah,
them?
Yeah, both.
Both. Well, she does both. She does some of both. Yes, she has a CD called Songs for Sophia, which, you know, you can see on our website. But, yeah, she's a singer. You know, that's part of who, what she does. So she, and most of the chants she does, she has written most on her CD, but not all. You know, she's worked with people like Starhawk. She went to work with Matthew Fox at originally ICCS and now Wisdom University. So, you know, a lot of those chants came out of her ritual work and work with people like that. And so there are some chants that aren't hers, but most of them are on her CD.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool on your website. You have pictures of life. And it's about people that you know and things like that. So out of those pictures of life that's on there, because some of them are kind of cool, which one do you think, if people take a look at it without even reading anything about it or knowing anything about it, would give them probably the best message?
That's a hard question, especially not looking at them right now. I don't know, you know. I'm not sure what would actually be so complete in a single picture. I mean, basically, a lot of the pictures are some of the real fun and exciting moments that we have shared in the world in different forms with different presenters and people. You know, we have a 2,000-square-foot space here, and we have lots of events here. So many of those pictures are taken in our studio. So I don't know if I have an answer for that as a single picture. I think just look at them and have fun. There are lots of them there, and they're, you know, there are some fun, interesting ones.
Actually, the ones I saw are kind of neat. When are your seminars and workshops? Is there a schedule that you guys go by?
Well, a lot of what we were doing, you know, which were real established workshops, we have left open to requests now. And so what we do now mostly is go to where we're asked to go and do what we're at and bring a particular work, you know, particular subject to work with at these places. So it's not like it used to be. I think the website and that level, you know, probably has to be updated a little, because those workshops are all available, but we no longer do them here. I took a lot of it off already that we used to do here, some of the big, more established workshops. So it's more, I don't know, my favorite thing to do is just go and be spontaneous in a moment. You know, I've done it, like, not too very long ago, which there are pictures in the Pictures of Life. I did an event with the heads of many CEOs of corporations in New York City, and there were people there, I mean, the most unlikely people for me, you know, someone who has hardly ever had a job, to be with all of these, you know, the second in line to Ben Bernanke, Rockefeller Foundation people. They brought me in to speak of the creative possibilities in living with less. So here, they brought the least person in to talk to the most people, which was kind of fun, exciting, and certainly challenging. But I love doing things. I love going where I'm out of my element and I don't know what I'm doing, and it's scary as hell. And I love what can come out of that kind of spontaneous challenge. So that's where my heart is. Whenever we do an established workshop, it's usually Marilyn's creation, because she's the master of that one. You know, I'm a bit more of a wild card. But I think if I'm in a situation, I can usually find what I need to serve the situation, and that's even what I do mostly in our workshops with Marilyn.
Do you work with, like, couples? You know, not necessarily. I know you work with groups, but do you just work with couples? Because I know you work with individuals and groups, but do you work with couples to help them get through, you know, what?
Yes,
like?
We have done that. You know, I mean, basically, we keep our lives open. We have a dormitory here with lots of beds, and our 2,000-square-foot space many people come pretty constantly, especially in the summer, and every imaginable thing happens. I think because of my story and because of what people are going through, many people want to come because they're going through their own metaphoric death in a certain sense, and they find some kind of hope in the possibility of, you know, from what they have been inspired by my story, they come here in the hopes that maybe there's somebody out there who understands what they're going through. So I think mostly what I do and what we do is keep our lives open to people. And it's really quite amazing how much and how many people come and how the surprises continue to come through and what happens. I mean, I had a woman just here recently who came out from Seattle to interview me. And, I mean, here's an example. And I, you know, so I was thinking, okay, we're going to do an interview. So she comes in, and she was so intense, and there was something going on under the surface. I had no idea what it was. We sit down to do the interview, and I was completely silent because I found absolutely no space to enter the conversation. And in that silence, she got very nervous, and then she broke down and cried. And what came out is she was suffering with cancer, and it was pretty serious. And then when we can cry and talk, and then that was the reality of the moment. It wasn't the interview. And then she ended up, I cooked her a meal. She ended up spending the night here with us. In the morning, she was all jazzed, and we did the interview. But I think that kind of thing is more what happens than the fixed and controlled, you know, little realities that we try to create for ourselves. And we're simply here as that kind of available for people. We always have been, and it's simply our way of life. I love what Yogananda says about having a family, because we don't have children, and neither of us ever really wanted to have children. You know, not that we don't love children, but Yogananda says, if you don't take responsibility for having children, then you must take responsibility for a much greater family. And I know that treating the world as if it were my family has been a way of life, and our life, I think, reflects that. And like families, you can get in some pretty messy tangles and confusions and everything else, but I think if the commitment is there and the determination to love even the most unlovable people, I think you can usually find a way to make it work and be in the service of life itself rather than your puny little idea of who you think you are. And I think, you know, generally speaking, that's what our lives are about here.
If somebody wanted to come to you, how would they go about doing that?
Well, people usually call. I get emails. I mean, I have this one young guy call me at 3 o'clock in the morning. He's troubled. And, you know, I mean, it happens every way. A lot of people read my book, and they, in one way or another, they are moved or touched or feel like they need support in ways that they think I might be able to support them. People find our website, friends of friends. I mean, I had someone bring a young girl, anorexic, 16-year-old here, and it was completely miraculous what ended up happening. But however, and it was her family who asked if they could bring her here for the day. So I mean, however it happens, but we're pretty available and out there in a way. You know, it's very rare that we say no. You know, sometimes you have to because you feel yes is unhealthy, and when there are certain expectations that have to do with old patterns, but I think saying no doesn't mean you're not waiting in the wings with a yes, looking for the right moment to jump into something. So people get here whatever way they can. I mean, I had a young artist come from the Midwest not too long ago with her son and came completely wired out, you know, just burned out on her life and hoping to find, you know, some new source of inspiration, and spent a couple of days. And I think, you know, it's just what we do.
If somebody wants to come, Jerry, is there a charge for any of it?
We don't charge anyone for anything like that. You know, we are simply available. What I find is that, you know, things come. You know, I've gotten, I've had a benefactor who supported my life for a few years. That has ended, but I think that's the way it happens. You know, right now, I don't know what we're doing. My wife, she's doing death midwifery work, which is a lot like home birth, except it's home death where people, you know, keep the body at the home and they do their own rituals and they wash the body. And my wife is kind of pioneering that kind of work. And so we're doing a little bit of everything at this point. But she was apprenticing to actually be a funeral director because it opens it. You just have more legal parameter in being a funeral director. But she just lost that job because of changes. And I don't, you know, financially we never know what we're doing. But I think we keep giving in it, and life gives back. I think it's a big part of how we're all being forced to live right now. This economy certainly changed. I mean, we were in Italy last summer, brought there. I mean, I think, you know, your life can go from looking incredibly lavish to absolute zero when you live the way I live, and we happen to be at a low point right now. But I don't live to make money. I never did. It hasn't been what my life's about. And somehow we work. It works. I mean, we own our home free and clear. We have no children. We can hunker down and live pretty minimally, just being the two of us.
I think in today's economy, whether you have children or not, you're going to have to hunker down anyway.
That's true.
And the sooner the people realize that, I think, actually, Jerry, the better off that they will end up being. You know, and it's not that you got to live poor, because I don't believe, you know, having faith, following, you know, your own intuition, I don't believe that's ever living poor. I believe that's just, you know, what you go through in order to get to a much higher place. Now, do you?
Well, and even literally, I mean, if you looked at our lives from the outside, you would think we were incredibly wealthy. Like I say, we were in Italy for 10 days last year, totally expenses paid. I mean, I travel. I mean, it's really pretty amazing how it can be, while on the other hand, with the flick of the wrist, you're in the dust. I mean, if you were attached to security, you certainly don't have it living this kind of life. But I think, you know, it's a beautiful, you can live a completely beautiful life, you know, trusting and giving. And, you know, we get what we give. That's the bottom line. And if we're not doing a whole lot of giving, then, and we're sitting around whining about what we don't have, then, you know, go get a job at McDonald's and go buy it or something. But don't complain.
Mm-hmm. What part of Italy were you in when you were there?
We were in Assisi, and also we went to Rome and a few other places while we were there, but we were brought to Assisi, and it was a pretty special time. I mean, Marilyn, I was there once before with the same person who brought me, and this time Marilyn got to come, so it was really special.
Okay. There's a place in Italy, I'm not exactly sure where it's located, but it's called Dharmahar. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of it, but I don't know. Is it that spiritual community?
Yeah, it's the spiritual community that actually built their own underground temple called
I've seen it online, and I've heard about it, yeah.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool, I think, to go see. I think they have another great way of believing on how to help people and keep them going. Do you guys still do your newsletters?
Yes. I mean, it's mostly, at this point, schedule information. And people are very interested in the new movie being made about my life, so I keep people updated on that. But, yeah, people can sign up for our newsletter. Marilyn and I both, we used to, you know, talk a lot about the adventures we were on while we were traveling. We toured for a couple of years pretty solidly between Parabola, the film, and then my book at that time. But I don't do a whole lot of that now. I'm pretty involved in this film. I can kind of only do one thing at a time completely.
And sometimes that's the best way to do it, make sure you get it done the right way.
Yeah.
Are you planning on doing any more books?
I didn't plan on doing a book to begin with. I have no plans. As a result of the book, and I also wrote monthly articles for New York City think tank, so there's a lot. I probably have enough for another book. I mean, if it happens, it would be fine. But I don't consider myself a writer. I'm certainly getting better at it by way of momentum and the force of having to do it at this point. But it's not something I necessarily want to do or don't want to do. If it happens, I'll do it.
That sounds kind of interesting. Out of the past events that you have done, is there any of them that you would like to repeat?
Well, I do have a sort of little longing. I loved, because of it was so outrageously out of the box, I love doing the work with the corporate people. And I also have, since that time, I had a group of John Hancock executives here. There was someone on the island who brought them here and wanted me to do a day's work with them. And it was just, I mean, it's so interesting being so completely out of my element and yet finding the language to work with people in a way that touches them. Because, you know, there's so much defense around being in the world and the things we do to make money that there's so little real humanity that can get through that defense. And I kind of really love the challenge of getting through, breaking through and delivering something and have unlikely people actually moved in a way and reminded in a deeper way who they really are. And so I think the events I love are the ones that I'm probably the least equipped to do, which are the corporate events. And it's because of the challenge and the attention required, I think I'm really at my best in a way that I like. I like to be in that vulnerable, creative, exciting place where I might fall on my face. And yet, so far I haven't. So that's what I would say. I love the corporate work I've been doing.
Do you think, Jerry, that a lot of the corporate people out there have somehow lost that sense of knowing who they are versus what they have?
I think it's absolutely true that they have, yes. I mean, there's something about the insanity of the workplace that has been so structured around money at any price and, you know, where humanity is so minimally tended that I think, you know, and then we think we're supposed, because we make money, we're supposed to buy a lot of things, and then we go in debt to get more things, and because our lives are so empty, we have to work more and buy more. And I think that cycle has just drained humanity of it, of the deeper mystery and of the, you know, the deeper meaning that is completely available and around us all the time. So, you know, generally speaking, it's sort of like that, you know, the story about if you put a frog in boiling water and just put in water and put a flame under it, the frog never realizes how hot it's actually getting and will die. I think that is what has happened in the workplace. You know, what used to be a pretty beautiful human exchange, a place where we exchanged goods and services and, you know, met people we fall in love with, and where it was so much more a social involvement, has become just a deadly business. And I think people have, the heat is up so high and people are, you know, literally dying, believing that there's nothing else to be done.
Yeah, and unfortunately I think you're right about that, and the heat needs to be turned down at least long enough so that people can wake up, is what I think, you know, because they have a little ways to go here. Now, when you did some of your past events, you've worked with several pretty big name people. Who was your favorite one?
Well, you know, some of my favorite people aren't necessarily big name people. You know, I, you know, there are people that are unexpected surprises. You know, like when we were in Italy, someone I had actually met at Chinook, who's who's kind of known, but not real known, Danny Martin. We had such a beautiful connection with him and spent our days walking in the hills of Assisi with Danny. I mean, there are a lot of, I don't know, you know, big and famous doesn't necessarily mean those people are easy or even open. You know, I mean, some of the most famous people I know are so narcissistic and so used to just, you know, walking away with the goods because everybody hands them the store, that there's not anyone really home there. So I don't know. I'm always surprised by what I find. And sometimes it's the most unlikely bag man who you meet on the street who comes through with the poetry, and the person you expect to be really great is actually quite boring and narcissistic. So it's an Easter egg hunt, and you never know where the good stuff's going to be found.
Stephen Simon was a person I'd interviewed a long time ago when he first started doing what, Dreams May Come?
So yeah, I did an event with him in Seattle.
Yeah, he's pretty interesting. I'm going to see if I can interview him again, if I can get a hold of him. Now, you also work with Deepak Chopra, which is one person that everybody just thinks is so grounded and so down to earth. Did you find that to be true?
Well, I didn't work intimately enough to know. You know, with the event there was one event I did with him where he presented as well. I mean, he arrived with two bodyguards, so how intimate can you get? I don't know. I don't know Deepak Chopra. I think he's one of the most brilliant orators and certainly has wisdom that this many of us need to hear, but I can't say I know a whole lot about him.
He's supposed to be pretty cool, but I've heard that before, that he does arrive at events with anywhere between 2 and 4 bodyguards, depending on where he's at and how big the event is, which I kind of find fascinating, I guess, because you would think that he should be pretty peaceful, but, you know, he is pretty well known, so I would think people would probably try to get too close to him. Before we run out of time, give out to the listeners your website, the name of your book, and the name of your movie, and let them know how they can get a hold of you, please.
Well, everything is on our website at handsofalchemy.com, ALCHEMY. My book is The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. The film is In the Hands of Alchemy. And you can reach me through our website. Our email and everything is there, handsofalchemy.com. My name is Jerry Winstrom.
And the movie, again, let's just a little bit. We have about 3 minutes left. So the movie is about your life. And
the feature, you're talking of the feature film.
The feature film is about your life.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's not been finished yet, right?
No, we're just beginning. The script is being hammered out. I mean, that's what I've been working on all day, actually, with Hans Fabian Wellenweber. There's information about the film on our website, too, if anyone was interested in seeing what's going on.
And for the documentary, which already has been done, is that right?
Yes. Well, that is it's a 30-minute documentary that just in a pretty Reader's Digest kind of poignant way, it speaks about my journey and the meaning, and it has poet, author David White, who narrates a good part of it, and really, I think he's the one who really brings it home. I remember when they were making the film, I just kept feeling like, we don't have a film here, until David came on and really brought it together. So I think it ended up really working well, and it was well received at the film festivals we participated in. So it was a gift. It was made by Phil Lucas, who's a Native American director for PBS and Turner Broadcast, and Mark Sedan, who's a filmmaker and quite famous photographer.
And they can purchase this documentary, right?
Yeah, it's a DVD. We sell them Sentient Publications, Amazon, anywhere, In the Hands of Alchemy.
Okay. Are you ever going to start to paint again, do you think?
Well, I incorporate painting into what I do now. If you look at some of my sculptures, you'll see painting that is, you know, they're box, they're large, 6 to 9 foot tall, and they're carved cedar and metallic objects, mechanical things that are whimsical, and some of them have paintings incorporated into them. They're multidimensional and interactive. So it's, you know, I just don't do painting for its own sake. I mean, I just did a painting of St. Francis as a gift for the person who brought us to Italy. So I do it. It's just not where my heart's at.
Okay. Again, one more time with your website so people can go find you.
It's handsofalchemy.com, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y, Hands of Alchemy.
All right. It's been a great time talking with you, Jerry. I liked your pictures that you destroyed, just so you know. I liked them. They were pretty interesting. And your sculptures are equally as interesting from the ones I've seen. So it's like, don't give up on doing them all together, okay? Because there's a lot there's a lot of energy that comes from it, and people are going to feel different things from them, and I think that's real important for people right now. So thank you for taking the time and explaining who you are and the things that you are doing, and we'll check you out a little bit later when you have some more stuff coming out and let me know, and maybe we'll bring you back.
Thank you, Nancy. I appreciate this opportunity.
You're very welcome, Jerry. You take care. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great week. And next week, we will have Colin Andrews as the guest. And he'll be talking about crop circles and many, many other topics. So take care, and we'll talk next week. Bye now.